You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Derek and Danny.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, Bob. What a glorious day.
Sounds like you're having to work to drum up the cheer, you know?
What a glorious day it is.
Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. It's also a crossover episode. The American Prestige Podcast, from where you guys come. And, you know, I think the topic of the day is pretty obvious. It's a war. I'm looking forward to this, actually, because I know, Derek, in particular, you've long paid very close attention to this region. You're paying close attention to the war as reflected in the daily updates published in your newsletter, Foreign Exchanges. I guess the first question is, are you guys coming around now to the view that Israel may have some influence on American foreign policy?
I'm not quite there yet, but yeah, I'm beginning to open my eyes.
It's been a long haul. I've been working on you guys, but I can see that illumination is coming. I mean, not that that's the only factor, but it was interesting the way it kind of burst into view. I mean, thanks largely to Marco Rubio's verbal deafness, the issue of where he basically said, yeah, look, we had to attack because Israel was going to attack. And it's not like we have influence over them. Like we could say, don't attack because if you do, we will not defend you or anything like that. So we just had no choice. Anyway, geez.
Got in a little trouble for that, but yeah.
Yeah, he did, which, you know, may matter because I gather there's an intramural dispute between him and Pete Hegseth over ground troops. Have you heard this? That Hegseth actually
not only has said it
out loud, but is agitating for it and Rubio's against it, or is that too much?
I haven't heard that. I mean, I'm not saying, I don't think it's too much. I think Pete Hegseth would pretty much advocate for anything. You get him at happy hour, he'll tell you anything. I don't know. I mean, that seems perfectly plausible, but I just haven't heard it.
On the happy hour point, just quickly, does he have an ongoing drinking problem? And does Lindsey Graham?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Is it libel? What's the one, the oral one?
No, the question isn't, the answer is. That's why I turned to you guys for the answer.
I see, yeah, okay. So get us a slander. We'll be slandered anyway.
Slander is the oral one, right? Libel is
never mind.
Correct.
Yeah. There are other ways to explain their behavior, I guess.
Well, the big one online is that Israel has blackmail against Lindsey Graham, right? That's what the online conspiracy theory.
Oh,
related to what? I would have no idea, but that they have blackmail related to Lindsey
Graham. I have no idea either. It couldn't involve sexual inclination. That's all. Israel would not stoop so low.
Never.
And
no, of course not.
So I doubt it's that. It's possible. Maybe he used a swear word after having a couple drinks or something and they have it on tape.
Yeah, that would be intense.
Let me do what the kind of layperson's recap that I think I have followed along with, and then you guys can expand and elaborate and answer the question where this may be heading. So obviously, unprovoked war that violates international law completely unnecessarily. Obviously, you're just asking for trouble. Almost anyone with any brains said to Trump, don't do this. The line about, now, I'm sure he was surprised by the magnitude and breadth of Iran's response. The line about the response, first of all, is that, you know, it's a rational response given where they are. They feel the regime is at stake. They want to send the message clearly to Gulf states that they should put pressure on Trump to end it. They want the financial markets to send him a message that he should end it, and so on. And, you know, there may have been some misfires, some mistakes. I gather that they have said that the whatever strait into Azerbaijani territory, I think they're saying was a mistake. But by and large, yes, their plan was to hit, first of all, U.S. bases in the area, even if they're in Gulf states that previously had been, you know, on not super bad terms with Iran. And beyond that, they're hitting some civilian targets and some energy targets. And but it all is part of this plan. That's the idea. And then I gather that as for Israel and America, you know, I think Trump's thinking has evolved. I honestly think he thought it might be kind of like Maduro. Like, you killed the leader.
Sure.
We got rid of the last leader and it was cool.
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't worked out like that. And I think whether he realizes or not, he's moving toward Israel's position, which is that, well, let me summarize. You know, there's this Israeli analyst I want to quote. And Derek, you may know of him.
I think I know the quote you're...
His name is Centrinowicz or Centrinowicz?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He seems good. I followed him a lot. He says, Israel's end game, he said, Israel's position is, quote, if we can have a coup, great. If we can have people in the streets, great. If we can have a civil war, great. Israel couldn't care less about the future. I think Trump, he's now talking about arming the Kurds. I mean, that is de facto alignment with Israel's position.
That's a given, I think, at this point, but yes.
And so that's, you know, it just seems like they just want, you know, now I think he's decided, look, what can I call a win? Regime collapse, I can call a win. And characteristically, right. He's not thinking more than like a nanosecond beyond that, right? Like, oh, but could what happens next tarnish your legacy and lessen the Republicans' chances in the midterms? Oh, we'll think about that later. But so I think that's where he's like, okay, but regime collapse would be a win. And so you arm the Kurds, and Israel is, of course, bombing policing infrastructure, just trying to induce a breakdown of order in Iran. So it seems like U.S. and American goals, because the other thing that this guy said, this analyst, is he said, this is a point of difference between the U.S. And us, meaning Israel. I think Washington is more concerned about nation building and threats to the regional partners. I think that distinction is less clear cut now. I think I
don't know that that's true. Like, I don't know how concerned the U.S. is about nation building. They are, I think, maybe a little bit concerned about the possibility of you know, a civil war or like raging conflict in the Gulf affecting energy, affecting, you know, commerce, affecting the Gulf's Arab states. But that's different from caring what emerges. Like this has been typical. This is what they did in Venezuela. Like, they didn't nation build in Venezuela. They took out Maduro, and now they're working with the same government. They just have a compliant proxy in Delcy Rodriguez and that establishment. But they don't care like what comes after. I didn't even think they care if the system collapses. If somebody like Ali Larijani or you know, right, one of these people who's like more pragmatic, quote unquote, who's still but is still heavily embedded in the Iranian system, were to take over and they could cut a deal with him, they'd be fine with that. So yeah, I mean, but you're right. I think the difference is, like, they would still like to see something coherent, and the Israelis just want to smash the place and like smash and grab and get out. And the U.S. is coming around to that, which is where this Kurdish operation comes into play.
And I do think that this is something unique since the end of World War II. I do think if you look to almost every American intervention since we entered the war in 1941, that there has been some form of ideological justification, or at least some sort of political project, that there was a strategic goal that was supposed to be aligned with something related to American values. Whether you thought that goal was bullshit, whether it was bullshit or whether it was not, I do think for the most part, some people believed it. But I do think that the fact that there really isn't that, the fact that, as we talked about before we started recording, there was even no attempt to manufacture consent, as many people commented on in the run-up to the war, indicates that we're in a new era. And I think we're in an era where this type of liberal hegemony, I don't mean that in a political sense, I just mean really sort of large L liberal hegemony that emerged with the United States after World War II, it has truly come apart. That the institutions are no longer considered legitimate, that the government isn't even making ideological justifications for particular U.S. foreign policy strategies. And so I think that we are in a new era of U.S. history. You know, we really are at the end of history. not in a ideological sense. You know, Fukuyama was some degree right. It's not liberalism was the last ideology, but it turns out liberalism is just going away, and now we've returned to, you know, pure capitalism and pure power politics. And this is, I think, an example of that, as was Maduro.
Here you go, Bob. This is an exclusive from Barak Ravid and Zachary Basu at Axios. President Trump told Axios in an interview Thursday that he needs to be personally involved in selecting Iran's next leader, just as he was in Venezuela. He revealed this exclusively in an 8-minute phone call with us to explain his war planning. He said, quote, "They are wasting their time," referring to Mojtaba Khamenei. He said Khamenei's son is a lightweight. He's considered the front runner to be supreme leader. "I have to be involved in the appointment, like with Delcy in Venezuela," end quote. So yeah, wow. Basically, both of these points are true. He expected this to be like Venezuela, and he doesn't really care who takes power. He just wants to be the person who picks them and gets to run it. Like,
I think if he establishes proxies. An Iranian board of peace, this should be doable, right? Derek, I was about to ask you, actually, that you mentioned Larijani, is that the correct pronunciation?
Larijani,
is that a plausible scenario? You mentioned the possibility of a relative moderate like him.
Point. Yeah.
You don't.
No. I think there was Larijani's probably got more authority right now than he had previously. He was sort of, you know, advising the Supreme Leader, Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. He's not part of the interim committee that took over when Khamenei was killed. That, by law, that's the president, the head of the judiciary, and one member of the assembly, I think, Assembly of Experts or Guardian Council. It's the assembly. Larijani isn't part of that group, but I'm sure he's you know, heavily involved in decision making right now. But no, I mean, if the stories that Mojtaba Khamenei is going to be the next supreme leader are true, then that's like they're just doubling down on the hard line. The decision's been taken that not only are they, you know, going for the hardest like candidate possible, they want somebody who is basically an Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps candidate to take power. So,
well, you had said in Foreign Exchanges, and actually we quoted you to this effect in this issue of the Non-Zero Network Digest, published at nonzero.org today, but that in any event, the successor was going to be very much somebody that the IRGC was happy with, somebody that could, to right. some considerable extent, do the IRGC's bidding. Does that mean that a large Johnny was never a realistic prospect in the first place?
I don't think so. I mean, yeah.
Are you saying basically there is no, I mean, obviously there's no, you know, strictly speaking, Maduro-like scenario, but is there any scenario in which the regime survives and works something out with Trump, in your mind? Or are we now looking at either regime survival and Trump finally kind of gives up and claims he won with no accommodation, no agreement about the future?
That's what I think is more likely than working on accommodation. I mean, they may agree to like something like we'll, you know, go back to negotiating. Not that they should, you know, that they would necessarily think that that's a path out of anything. But no, I mean, I think it's going to have to be Trump gets bored and says, we won, and, you know, everything just kind of...
Or regime collapse, which goes presumably is a real prospect, right?
Sure. I mean, regime collapse is that. But if the regime survives with the structure that it sounds like is going to come out of this, is basically more of a military government than a clerical government, I don't see... the possibility of a deal, or certainly of what's happened in Venezuela, where Rodriguez is just taking orders from DC and doing what they want. I can't imagine that would be the outcome.
Yeah. At the beginning of this, I was imagining maybe, early on that Iran goes back and they basically wind up with a deal, something like what was on the table to begin with when we started bombing, except that Trump can say, "Oh, we got this in addition," whether that's true or not. But at this point, That seems like a pretty unlikely prospect. And I mean, on the regime collapse thing, so first of all, I mean, we can talk about the Kurds in a second and the idea of fomenting, you know, nationalist insurrections and stuff. But the
always
the
works out.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, from Israel's point of view, fine. And I mean, Trump doesn't actually give a shit, except to the extent that it reflects badly on him. And I would hope it would, but you never know with American politics. But anyway, the on the regime collapse thing, you know, they're bombing the policing infrastructure. They're trying to bring down the instruments of maintaining order. And I would think that's at beyond some point kind of doable if you are sufficiently dominant militarily, which brings up a couple of questions.
Doable, Bob? Sorry, that what? Regime collapsed through air war, just to clarify.
Well, the breakdown of order in Iran. Yeah, I mean, they know where all the police stations are. They know where the besieged, you know.
It rarely works. I mean, this was the promise of air war going back to the 1920s, and it just seems that even devastating air war.
You couldn't target police stations. You couldn't target police stations in the 20s.
Yeah, but they would even look at World War II. They targeted everything, and it didn't lead to regime collapse. It very rarely. I think, Derek, what is the only instance? Is it the atomic bombs? I mean, that's what the air war people always point to as ending a war.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't think there are any other instances of air war actually ending a war. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, I'm not talking about ending
the
war. I'm talking about just a breakdown of order within Iran.
Collapse of social order. Yeah, but that even that's pretty hard. I mean, even that didn't happen in Nazi Germany until the very, very last few weeks of the war. It just seems like, for whatever reason, societies don't collapse as a result of air war.
Okay, but again, the technology, I just think this is a completely different situation. Israel has extensive intelligence penetration. They know where everything is. So I think pretty soon it becomes a question of to what extent is Iran's retaliatory capacity intact, right? Like, if they can keep raining down shit, and it gets to a point where we've exhausted our capacity to, you know, our air defense capacity, then maybe Israel and the U.S. would have to stop. But if they don't, there's just almost no limit to how much havoc they can wreak. And they can do it in a pretty precisely, relatively. I mean, obviously, you kill the occasional 150 schoolgirls. Sorry about that. But, you know, compared to World War II, it can be.
But it's more of a social question. I think, to my mind, it's more of a social and political question than it is a question of precision strategic bombing. I mean, you could look at it from the other perspective. Actually, less precision would have been better because now you're just wreaking havoc all over a society. I just think that this dream of precision air war. I just don't think it's. I think it's a political and social question. And from my understanding, and Derek is more of an expert in this, there doesn't seem to be a political opposition that would be ready to achieve power. So at best, you would get a total social collapse. But even that seems to rarely happen as a result of pure air war, which is why I think they're going to send in special forces. That's what I think is going to happen. And I think it's going to happen relatively quickly. I think they're going to try to do an Afghanistan type operation where it's less mass troops, more special forces, and then you're going to go in on the ground and try to. Control essentially key sites around the country. That to me, more than air war, would I think lead to the situation that you're describing, Bob. But I don't know, Derek, if you agree or disagree.
I mean, there isn't an organized opposition in the country that can take over. There is the diaspora opposition, but it's very hard to say how much like purchase Reza Pahlavi has. Inside Iran, like there were people chanting his name in the protests back in January. But, you know, were they doing that because they really want Reza Pahlavi to restore the Pahlavi dynasty or because they just needed a figure to cling on to, you know, kind of express their anger to the government? Who knows? It's just fundamentally bizarre to say we want the Iranian people to rise up and overthrow their government. While we're bombing the country, like people don't do that. People's instincts when their cities are being destroyed are to run and hide and save their families, their children, mm-hmm. and their lives. And you can't marry those two things together. So I do think, you know, leaving aside like the rallies, you know, the quote unquote rally around the flag effect, which may not be relevant here. Anybody who's going to rally around this country's flag has already done so. But leaving that aside, like, you're asking people to take their, you know, destiny into their own hands, but, you know, try not to get hit by a cruise missile while you're doing it. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
I mean,
as it's never happened.
As a approach.
Historically, okay, but, it just has never happened.
Then, Derek, what do you have in mind when you say regime collapse is possible? What does that look like? The version you think
that,
is possible?
That looks like arming the Kurds and sending them in from the West and then starting to Balkanize the country. I think you could do all sorts of things. The Kurds can hold on to territory. And then you've got Azeri militants they can interact with. They can serve as a conduit for the CIA or the you know, U.S. military to get weapons and support to other groups. They can draw the attention of Iranian security forces so that groups in the south, the Arab militant groups, or in the southeast, some of the Sunni jihadist groups, essentially Jaish al-Adl and so forth, could have more space to operate. And then you're just asking, like, all these different groups to pick apart the state, you know, and take down with diminished capacity. And as you say, I mean, they're bombing police stations, they're bombing IRGC command facilities. Like, you're trying to take down that capacity to resist, but that's what you're doing. You're just asking all these groups to, yeah, to,
I mean,
of, you know,
I'd emphasize that I'm not suggesting there's a scenario of orderly succession or a clear, right, coherent group that takes over. I'm talking about just disorder in the first place, chaos. And maybe the two are the same, because maybe if there's just no group that can rival the regime for imposing some degree of order, then there's a limit to how much order can break down because people don't want it. I don't know. But on the Kurd thing, maybe you can answer this question. So one reason I was surprised to read that an Iranian missile had been shot down while heading into Turkish territory is that when I had tried to play out in my mind, like, ways that this war could get really big, and right, I had already heard that Trump was thinking about arming the Kurds, the first thought was, well, I can imagine Iran saying to Erdogan, hey, we could use some help with the Kurds, and Erdogan saying, you know, always happy to do airstrikes against Kurds who have weapons, and Turkey becoming a kind of, you know, getting slowly drawn into this on Iran's side. Now, maybe that was, I'm not an expert on the area, maybe that was crazy to begin with, but in any event, what is it? What is a Turkish missile doing heading, I mean, what is an Iranian missile doing headed toward Turkey? But because Turkey, of course, is the closest thing, I guess, Iran has to a big, powerful non-adversary in the region, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And you're right. I mean, there are elements of this Kurdish coalition that they've put together, in particular the Kurdistan Free Life Party, which is affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers Party, that the Turks would be very unhappy about being involved in something like this, and have expressed already some concern, have said that they're, you know, sort of monitoring this. I don't think they would necessarily get involved in the war on Iran's side or anything like that, but that's a real concern for the Turks for sure, and that's something you could sort of play with if you were the Iranians to try and make things less comfortable for the U.S. I there's a couple of things I would say about the missile launch. One is that we know, because the Iranian officials have said so, that they don't have control over all of their military units right now. They instituted policies of kind of decentralization and atomization before the war that give local commanders and units autonomy and latitude. That was their explanation for the strike on Oman a couple of days ago, that they said, you know, this wasn't what we wanted. It was, you know, a unit that was operating autonomously that did this. You know, they give them guidance in terms of targets. I don't know if you can draw a complete conclusion about where this missile was heading, given that it was intercepted midair, but it seems like it was heading toward Incirlik Air Base, given where it was taken down. I think it was in Syrian airspace.
That's a U.S. base.
It's a Turkish base that the U.S. uses. Yeah, they kind of cohabitate. And the U.S. has I think, or did at one point have tactical nukes there. May still have. I don't know. Mm. But the given where it was shot down, given that there was wreckage that landed or that came down apparently in Hatay province in Turkey, which is right on the way to Incirlik, you can probably conclude that was the intended target. It's a stupid thing to do. I mean, I'm not going to argue with you. Like, you know, bringing Turkey into the war or just on its own merits, if that were to happen, it would be very dumb. And it also, would deprive the Iranians of not a potential ally, certainly, but a potential non-adversary, as you put it. So that would be extremely dumb. And the Turks haven't given the U.S. permission to use Incirlik against Iran in airstrikes. Mm-hmm. So, it's attacking a facility mm-hmm. that's not even really involved in the war. I do agree. If that was done with intention and it wasn't done as a mistake or by some, mid-level commander who didn't really grasp the geopolitics of it, then yeah, it was not a good idea for them. They're probably lucky that it got shot down.
Are there any other parts of Iran's retaliation that seem to you to have been kind of counterproductively undiscerning in a sense? In other words,
what else can they do?
I mean,
they have to impose cost. I mean, like,
right.
So like this is they're really in a difficult place because they're not that powerful, but they did this deal last summer and then within a year they're bombed again. It is just like a strategy from the Western powers to essentially force them to radicalize. I truly don't see the geostrategy here because they have to be undiscerning. They basically will likely conclude they need to have a nuclear weapons program. This is probably going to convince other powers that they need to have a nuclear weapons program. So I just don't see what they would do.
I just mean, you can imagine they strike U.S. bases in the area and energy infrastructure and don't do hotels in Dubai. I'm just saying it's a pretty broad range but I'm just raising the question.
Right, but if you're trying to disrupt economically, if you're trying to disrupt the Gulf, and I think there was an initial thought that like maybe if we cause some pain to the Gulf states, they will go to Trump and say this isn't worth mm-hmm. it, please stop. I don't think they can't possibly be operating under that delusion at this point. I don't know why they would have thought it in the first place, because the Gulf states, although we don't know, there was reporting that MBS was on the phone with Trump urging him to move forward. The Saudis have denied that, and it wasn't really well sourced. It was in the Washington Post, but it was anonymously sourced and all that type of thing.
And this was after the Washington Post fired its entire
right after they fired everybody. Yeah, it's hard to know. So overtly, at least, you had all these governments, kind of pushing back against a conflict. And it didn't matter. Like it didn't do anything. Like it didn't stop the U.S. didn't stop Israel. So I don't think they can be operating under the delusion that now, if the Saudis and the UAE go to the U.S. or Qatar or whoever and says, please mm-hmm. knock this off, that it's going to have any effect. But they do want to cause just general economic pain. And this is where they can do it most easily. It's a major, shipping region. It's a major energy, obviously, region. And they're able to use their drones against these targets because they're close enough. And the drones have been very successful in contrast to the missiles, which, mostly seem to get intercepted. The drones seem to be getting through. They're using a lot of them, but they're cheap. They're easy to make. And you only have to hit on, a percentage of your launches to cause real damage. And so that's what they're doing. I tend to agree with Danny. Like there's not, they don't have a whole lot of options here. The one concern that they may have is that the Pakistani government apparently, informed them that if Saudi Arabia gets involved in the war, and they haven't so far, that Pakistan, they could activate their mutual defense treaty with Pakistan, and Pakistan would have to get involved. The Pakistanis are at war with Afghanistan right now, so they've got other things on their plate, but that could be a problem for the Iranians if that were to happen. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, they've got to treat this as somewhat existential. So I think that's what they're doing.
And on the drones versus missiles thing, so there was a Washington Post piece, I think yesterday, about how a lot of the missiles are now kind of trapped in these underground missile cities. And this is, you know, because they've been the exits to those places have been bombed. And this is consistent with a thread I saw a few days before the war by an apparently credible analyst who's followed by a lot of people I know who said, you have to understand, unlike in the June war, this time, given the U.S. military assets in place, they can reach all of the underground missile sites and bomb the entrances, exits. They can't get the missiles out. Now, the Washington Post says this has now happened. And it does seem that I have noticed, it seems like over the last day or two, there has been a decrease. In fact, to some extent, I think the decrease in missile strikes is documented. But even beyond that, I just haven't seen so much footage on social media of even drones actually hitting stuff. You know, like originally there was this footage of them hitting like the radar installation in this Arab state and this and that. My sense is that the level of retaliation is either significantly less effective now or not being well documented. In any event, it may be that the problem with the missiles isn't just that they get shot down, because when they do that, they still have the virtue of exhausting a lot of defense capacity, right? When they rain them down on Israel from Iran's point of view, they have that virtue. But it may be they can't even get them. They don't have access to the missiles. They can't fire them.
Yeah. I mean, I think they made the decision to go slower on the missiles in general. I mean, the tempo of their attacks on Israel, which is where they would really rely on ballistic missiles, has been lower. And that was from the start. That isn't something, although the Pentagon did say the other day, Dan Kane, I think, said they're seeing a slowdown in missile launches. I don't know about the drones. I don't know that there's been a reduction in tempo, or if we're just not getting reporting, because these are famously opaque states where these attacks are taking place, and they're not sharing the video the way that was happening previously. I just don't know that you can draw any conclusions about that.
Okay. In a few minutes, we should go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the American Prestige podcast and the Non-Zero podcast. And I want to talk about, a number of things in there, including the Israel thing. But first, before we do, anything else on the overall global take, including how cravenly every European leader outside of the Prime Minister of Spain, I guess, has become Trump's lapdog, basically, notwithstanding, a few footnotes issued by Keir Starmer after, agreeing to let the U.S. use their base. Any takes
on,
the
Europeans have beclowned themselves. Mark Carney has been, doing some really amazing kind of bending and stretching to get away with saying that he thinks this war is against, it violates international law, but he also supports it with regret, and he would be involved in it if he was asked, but it's bad, but we'll still do it. It's the same, maneuver that the Democrats are doing to say, we oppose the war, but we're going to vote to fund it if it comes to that. Some extraordinarily flexible people. These guys should all be, doing some kind of show somewhere where they show off their stretching ability.
Danny, do you have any thoughts on why the Europeans fell in line with Trump?
Because
so
what
readily?
Else are they going to do? They're fundamentally weak.
Right.
This is just the reality of power politics. I think
What do they fear Trump doing if they don't?
The United States totally disengaging. I think that's all. I think this is Europe has really, for generations now, just relied on American power. And so they really have no other option regarding whatever bleeding they might do otherwise. So they just have to fall in line. They're essentially a vassal region of the United States. And I don't think it's more complicated than that. I think that they have to do it, and they can't even pursue an independent foreign policy. Not really. Yeah. And I think that's why.
So, but what are they afraid of? Russia? I mean, is that the fear that, I mean, what will Trump not defend them against?
Russia, disengagement, the United States imposing some tariff, the United States removing troops. They're afraid of everything because they're a vassal region, effectively. I mean, that, Derek, that's how I view it. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Like, I mean, you know, there's certainly, it doesn't take much. Like, the U.S. doesn't have to do anything proactive to Europe. They just have to say, okay, we're not going to defend you guys anymore. And then Russia becomes a concern, or any number of other things. I mean, you know, they're just, but also, like, we can't discount the importance of just learned helplessness, which is what Europe has been, you know, wallowing in for decades. Like, this is just how decades, these people came up. You know, Starmer, Macron, all of these people, Friedrich Merz, Mark Rutte, like, they all developed their formative years were spent in a system where Europe was the helpless, you know, vassal of the United States. And that's just what they know. Like, they don't know any other way of functioning, I think, on some level.
Okay. Well, let's do
maybe, Bob, maybe in in overtime, we can talk about this sinking of the Iranian ship that was unarmed in international waters. And
that, and I want to talk about the expansion of the war into Lebanon. And I want to talk again about Israel. Well, if we're talking about Lebanon, we're talking about Israel. And I want to talk about the etymology of the phrase learned helplessness a bit. Maybe I'll begin with a short lecture on learned helplessness, just because it's interesting the way it's entered the lexicon and it has its origins in rat behavior, as I will.
Also, it has its origins in fake psychology.
No, I think the finding is valid as far as it goes. It didn't mean exactly.
All right. Let's get to overtime.
Okay. Yeah. No. You have to pay for this punchline, folks. We're going no further. You know, if you're a paid subscriber to one of our podcasts, you get the rest of this enlightenment. Thanks, everybody else. Even if you're not going to follow us, for following this far, rate and review, and then. Rate and review. Thanks.